Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear reports from Mario Ritter Jr. and Jill Robbins. Later, John Russell presents this week's Everyday Grammar Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says she plans to step down. Ardern was 37 years old when she became the head of the government of the Southern Pacific Island Nation and U.S. ally. The Labour Party politician will have served 5.5 years when she officially leaves power. Many observers say she was an example of a new kind of leadership. However, more recently, Ardern has faced increasing political pressure to step down. The Prime Minister told reporters in Napier that her last day in office would be February 7th. She said, "I know what this job takes, and I know that I no longer have enough in the tank to do it justice. It is that simple." Labour Party lawmakers will vote for a new leader on Sunday. New elections are to take place on October 14th. Ardern became Prime Minister in 2017. She was a generation younger than other world leaders. She became the second world leader to give birth while in office. Her life partner is Clark Gayford. She won praise for the way she dealt with a mass shooting in March 2019. A gunman attacked a Muslim religious center in Christchurch, killing 51 people. Ardern and her Labour Party then pushed through Parliament a law banning most semi-automatic guns. Police bought back more than 50,000 guns from New Zealanders under a government program. About 9 months after the shooting, 22 foreign visitors and local guides were killed in a volcanic explosion on White Island. Early in the COVID-19 world health crisis, Ardern won praise from many for the way she dealt with public health. Her government ordered lockdowns and severe measures to prevent the spread of COVID-19. However, by 2021, the Prime Minister was forced to ease the zero-tolerance policy. Highly infectious versions of the virus had spread around the world by that time. Demonstrations against government vaccination requirements began in 2022, continued several weeks, and ended with fighting between protesters and police. The Royal Commission of Inquiry is expected to present a report on the government's COVID-19 policies next year. Ardern supported legislation aiming to require New Zealand to produce net-zero carbon gases, but farmers opposed proposed taxes and other measures aimed at preventing the release of carbon gases at farms. In 2020, her Labour Party gained the most seats in Parliament. But current public opinion studies show her party has less support than the conservative opposition. Ardern said, "I am not leaving because it was hard." But she added that her position involved the responsibility to know when you are the right person to lead and also when you are not. Her supporters blamed angry people for opposition to her leadership. Actor Sam Neill said on Twitter, "Her treatment in the last few months has been disgraceful and embarrassing." But Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said she has shown the world how to lead with intellect and strength. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau thanked Ardern for her friendship and empathic leadership. Ardern was first elected to Parliament in 2008. Before joining government, she was a policy expert for former British Prime Minister Tony Blair and was elected president of the International Union of Socialist Youth. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
U.S. government lawyers announced Thursday that actor Alec Baldwin will be charged with involuntary manslaughter in the shooting death of a cinematographer while filming a movie in New Mexico. Santa Fe District Attorney Mary Carmack Altwies issued a statement announcing the charges against Baldwin and Hannah Gutierrez Reed, who supervised weapons on the movie set. Cinematographer Helena Hutchins died shortly after being wounded during rehearsals for the movie Rust on October 21, 2021. Baldwin was pointing a handgun at Hutchins when the gun went off, killing her and wounding the film director, Joel Souza. Santa Fe County Sheriff Adan Mendoza led the investigation into Hutchins' death. He described a degree of neglect on the film set. But his report did not say how live ammunition got on the film set. Filmmakers usually use ammunition without bullets, called blanks, on movie sets. Baldwin was the co-producer of Rust. He is well known for his acting on the television show 30 Rock and for his work in the film The Hunt for Red October. Baldwin has described the killing as a tragic accident. He is taking legal action against people involved in handling and supplying the gun that was handed to him on the set. The actor said he was told the gun was safe. In his lawsuit, Baldwin said he pointed the weapon in Hutchins' direction while practicing with camera angles on the set. The gun then discharged. New Mexico's Office of the Medical Investigator had ruled that the shooting was an accident after examining Hutchins' death and law enforcement reports. And New Mexico's Occupational Health and Safety Bureau has fined the movie production company for safety failures. A lawyer for Hannah Gutierrez Reed said she did not put live ammunition in the gun that killed Hutchins. Gutierrez Reed says she believes she was the victim of sabotage. But officials say they have found no evidence of that. Investigators found 500 pieces of ammunition at the movie set outside of Santa Fe. They were a mix of blanks and what appeared to be live ammunition. industry experts have said live ammunition should never be on a movie set. The family of Hutchins has settled a lawsuit against the producers of Rust. The agreement aims to restart filming the movie with Hutchins' husband as a producer. I'm Jill Robbins.
Imagine a person asks you about your favorite piece of art. How do you answer? In today's Everyday Grammar, we will explore how you can talk about art and the reasons that you like it. Let us begin with a question. A person asks you the following.
What is your favorite piece of art?
Pay special attention to the word favorite. It means a thing that is liked more than others. You can answer the question in a couple of ways. One way is to use the following structure.
My favorite piece of art is...
In general, we identify the artist and the name of the artwork after the verb be. You can use the possessive form to identify the name of the artist and the artwork, as in...
My favorite piece of art is Vincent van Gogh's The Starry Night.
In this case, the possessive marker, apostrophe S, is of special importance. It shows that the artwork, The Starry Night, was made by the artist Vincent van Gogh. If you do not want to use the possessive marker, apostrophe S, you can use the name of the artwork followed by the word by, as in...
My favorite piece of art is The Starry Night by Vincent van Gogh.
And what if you do not have a favorite piece of art? Such an exchange might go like this. What is your favorite piece of art?
I don't have a favorite piece of art.
Or?
I don't really enjoy art.
Now imagine that a person asks you the following during an English test.
What is your favorite piece of art? Why?
You should probably give your best, most detailed answer. Such an answer would clearly state the piece of art and explain the reasons you like it. For example, you might say,
My favorite piece of art is Hokusai's The Great Wave. I love woodblock prints, and the Berlin blue color he uses is so lovely. In addition, I find the subject matter so powerful. The giant wave is such a danger to those fishermen.
Or you could say,
My favorite piece of art is The Great Wave by Hokusai. I love the print because I enjoy learning about Japanese history. For me, the wave represents a giant force of change crashing down on society.
In the first example, the reasons given for liking the artwork relate to the kind of art, the woodblock print, the color, Berlin blue, and the subject matter, Japanese history. In the second example, the reasons given for liking the artwork connect to the possible meaning of the artwork and its connection to history. So, when you give reasons for liking an artwork, there are many ways to do so. You can talk about colors or the lack of colors, point of view, the kind of art, painting, calligraphy, sculpture, the artwork's connection with history and society, and so on. Today we have explored some ways to talk about your favorite piece of art. There are certainly more ways to do so. Still, let us try to use some of what we have explored today. Write us a short message, 3 to 5 sentences, about your favorite piece of art. You can send your message to learningenglish@voanews.com. Your message does not have to be about a painting. It can be about a sculpture, writing such as calligraphy, or even photography. I'm John Russell.
You just heard John Russell present this week's Everyday Grammar Report. John is here now to talk more about the story. Welcome back, John.
Thanks, Ashley.
In the report today, you describe a couple different ways to talk about a favorite artwork. You could use the artist's name with the possessive marker, apostrophe S, or you could use the short word by. Can you tell our listeners whether or not there is a difference between these two?
Let's take an example. You could say, my favorite work of art is Leonardo da Vinci's The Mona Lisa. Or you could say, my favorite work of art is The Mona Lisa by Leonardo da Vinci. Both of these statements are acceptable, correct, and polite. There is a small difference in terms of grammar, but in terms of the actual meaning, they are exactly the same.
Great. Thanks for answering that question, John. And thanks for being here today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Civil War ended in 1865. After that, tensions grew between Congress and the new president, Andrew Johnson. The Republican Party was still new. It was formed to oppose slavery. Radical members of the party controlled Congress. They wanted strong policies to punish the southern states that left the Union and lost the war. Standing in the way of the Republicans was Andrew Johnson, a Democrat. The president opposed radical efforts to force solutions on the South. He vetoed a number of programs that he thought interfered with rights given to the states by the Constitution. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of President Andrew Johnson.
In the congressional elections of 1866, radicals won firm control of both houses of Congress. They were able to pass a number of bills over the president's veto. But Johnson refused to stand aside in the face of radical attempts to seize all powers of government. This conflict between Johnson and the Congress caused much bitterness. Finally, the radicals decided to get him out of the way. For the first time in American history, Congress would try to remove the president from office. Under the United States Constitution, the House of Representatives has the power to bring charges against the president. The Senate acts as the jury to decide if the president is guilty of the charges. The Chief Justice of the United States serves as judge. If 2/3 of the senators find the president guilty, he can be removed from office.
Radicals in the House of Representatives brought 11 charges against President Johnson. Most of the charges were based on Johnson's removal from office of his Secretary of War. Radicals charged that this violated a new law. The law said the president could not remove a cabinet officer without approval by the Senate. Johnson refused to recognize the law. He said it was not constitutional. Radicals in the House of Representatives also charged Johnson with criticizing Congress. They said his statements dishonored Congress and the presidency.
The great impeachment trial began on March 5, 1868. The president refused to attend, but his lawyers were there to defend him. One by one, the senators swore an oath to be just. They promised to make a fair and honest decision on the guilt or innocence of Andrew Johnson. A congressman from Massachusetts opened the case for the radicals. He told the senators not to think of themselves as members of any court. He said the Senate was a political body that was being asked to settle a political question. Was Johnson the right man for the White House? He said it was clear that Johnson wanted to overthrow Congress. Other radical Republicans then joined him in condemning Johnson. They made many charges, but they offered little evidence to support the charges.
Johnson's lawyers called for facts instead of emotion. They said the Constitution required the radicals to prove that the president had committed serious crimes. Andrew Johnson had committed no crime, they said. This was purely a political trial. They warned of serious damage to the American form of government if the president was removed for political reasons. No future president would be safe, they said, if opposed by a majority of the House and two-thirds of the Senate.
The trial went on day after day. The decision would be close. 54 senators would be voting. 36 votes of guilty were needed to remove the president from office. It soon became clear that the radicals had 35 of these votes. Only 7 senators remained undecided. If one of the 7 voted guilty, Johnson would be removed. Radicals put great pressure on the 7 men. They tried to buy their votes. Party leaders threatened them. Supporters in the senators' home states were told to write hundreds of letters demanding that Johnson be found guilty.
A senator from Maine was one who felt the pressure, but he refused to let it force him to do what others wished. He answered one letter this way, "Sir, I wish you and all my other friends to know that I, not they, am sitting in judgment upon the president. I, not they, have sworn to do impartial justice. I, not they, am responsible to God and man for my action and its results." A senator from Kansas was another who refused to let pressure decide his vote. He said, "I trust that I shall have the courage to vote as I judge best."
In the final days before the vote, 6 of the 7 remaining Republican senators let it be known that they would vote not guilty. But the senator from Kansas still refused to say what his vote would be. His was the only vote still in question. His vote would decide the issue. Now, the pressure on him increased. His brother was offered $20,000 for information about how the senator would vote. Everywhere he turned, he found someone demanding that he vote guilty. The vote took place on May 16th. Every seat in the big Senate room was filled. The Chief Justice began to call on the senators. One by one, they answered, guilty or not guilty. Finally, he called the name of the senator from Kansas.
The senator stood up. He looked about him. Every voice was still. Every eye was upon him. It was like looking down into an open grave, he said later. Friendship, position, wealth, everything that makes life desirable to an ambitious man were about to be swept away by my answer. He spoke softly. Many could not hear him. The Chief Justice asked him to repeat his vote. This time, the answer was clearly heard across the room. Not guilty.
The trial was all but done. Remaining senators voted as expected. The Chief Justice announced the result. On the first charge, 35 senators voted that President Johnson was guilty. 19 voted that he was not guilty. The radicals had failed by one vote. When the Senate voted on the other charges, the result was the same. The radicals could not get the two-thirds majority they needed. President Johnson was declared not guilty.
Radical leaders and newspapers bitterly denounced the small group of Republican senators who refused to vote guilty. They called them traitors. Friends and supporters condemned them. None was reelected to the Senate or to any other government office. It was a heavy price to pay. And yet they were sure they had done the right thing. The senator from Kansas told his wife, "The millions of men cursing me today will bless me tomorrow for having saved the country from the greatest threat it ever faced."
He was right. The trial of Andrew Johnson was an important turning point in the making of the American nation. His removal from office would have established the idea that the president could serve only with the approval of Congress. The president would have become, in effect, a prime minister. He would have to depend on the support of Congress to remain in office. Johnson's victory kept alive the idea of an independent presidency. However, the vote did not end the conflict between Congress and the White House over the future of the South. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.